Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. If you were up at the crack of dawn this morning, you will know that earlier today, well, actually, from 9 until 11 a.m., we broadcast a very special programme right here on RTE Radio 1 and on the RTE News Channel. It's winter, and our focus was on two of Ireland's most fascinating groups of birds, wading birds and garden birds. We started with the stunning wetlands that stretch across this beautiful island. They're a vital lifeline for thousands of birds, especially as winter sets in. When food becomes scarce elsewhere, these wetlands provide a rich, bountiful feeding ground for wading birds like curlews, oyster catchers, and godwits. Birds that literally fly thousands of kilometres just to escape the harsh conditions further north. Now, I was in a nice warm studio along with Richard Collins, but braving the elements on our behalf, and indeed yours, at the North Bull Wall in the heart of Dublin Bay Biosphere, where Terry Flanagan and Niall Hatch.
Good morning, Derek. Good morning, Richard. Good morning, listeners. A beautiful morning it is, too, here at one of my favourite places to watch birds, North Bull Island in Dublin. It's a stunning morning, Terry, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely fabulous. We were here much earlier. We were here before dawn. Now, it was a beautiful dawn, but it was very windy, and I thought, oh, my God, this is not going to work so well today. But believe it or not, the wind has died down, the sun is shining, and we're having stunning views here. Now, where we are at the moment, we're not far from the old wooden bridge. The wooden bridge has been there for about 200 years. In fact, it's not the only wooden bridge, because if you look at it, not at this time of the day, but if you look at it at the low tide, you will see that there are stumps underneath it. So there was an old wooden bridge, one prior to that, in the very, very same position. But we have to come over the wooden bridge, and we're just literally on the far side of it. And behind us we have the chimneys, the Poolbeg chimneys that are well known to everybody in Dublin. We've got the Poolbeg lighthouse behind us, we have the South Bull Wall, and of course we have the pigeon house. But Niall, I don't think we're going to see many pigeons today.
Well, we could see some, but they're not the focus of the programme. Pigeon House, of course, not named after the birds at all, is that right?
John Pigeon, isn't that who it was?
It is, yes, absolutely. We're here to celebrate the wetland birds we get here, and particularly the waders, for which Bull Island here is so important. It's such a wonderful spot. To have an oasis like this, part of a UNESCO biosphere reserve, in so close to the centre of a capital city is quite remarkable. Yeah. And I think it's a real treat to see, be able to see the birds such close quarters. That's one of the reasons why we selected this location.
And of course, the reason for that is in the 1700s, Dublin Port was a very busy port, but there was a main problem with it was that it used to silt up. So they decided, oh, let's try and desilt the port, or whatever the correct term is. So they built the South Bull Wall. It wasn't really very, very successful. And then in 1800, a very famous man, an engineer called Captain Bligh, the same man of the mutiny, he came up with the idea of the North Bull Wall. And the North Bull Wall and the South Bull Wall together, it scoured out the bay. And but what happened then, the interesting thing that happened then, is that the sand was thrown out and it was thrown around, and it scoured the central channel, all right, but it formed the Bull Island where we are now. And the Bull Island is completely made of sand, and it's actually growing every year.
It is, it's expanding all the time, and it's just a build-up of sand there. And in the process of those engineering works, it's actually created an astonishing wildlife habitat. It's the kind of thing, I think if you propose those works today, it wouldn't be allowed on environmental grounds, but actually, inadvertently, they created this amazing habitat, a mixture of salt marsh, sand dune systems, estuarine mudflats that are so rich in the invertebrates, the small creatures, that these waders and other birds like the brent geese, they come to eat the grass here as well. It's an absolute melting pot for a whole load of different wading birds and migrant species from all over the Northern Hemisphere. It's quite astonishing.
Yeah, and we're just looking at the views of it there. Lovely views. What a beautiful morning. Look at those chimneys there too.
Iconic part of Dublin, aren't they? And then, of course, we see some of the birds as well. A lot of people say to me, it's very hard to identify waders, isn't it? They all look the same. Well, one bird that doesn't look like the others is the oyster catcher, one of the easiest waders to identify, because it's mainly black and white, unlike the palette of browns and greys that the other waders have.
But can I tell the story about the oyster catcher? Because when I was young, back in the 60s, in the early 60s, we used to come out here pretty much every Sunday, the family, and we'd come across across the wooden bridge. I hated that because you look down between it and you see the sea. You think you're going to fall into it. But I remember, because I was only getting interested in birds at that time, and I remember saying to my dad, who was driving at the time, I said, "Oh, look, look, there's magpies over there." And he laughed at me. I didn't know why. But then he said, "They're oyster catchers." And in fact, he didn't use that term. He used the term mussel pickers. He never liked the term oyster catchers because they don't eat oysters and they don't catch anything.
Yeah, I like to think of them as being the Molly Malone bird, especially here in Dublin, because their main food is cockles and mussels. That's what they like. Yeah. But they also like, they'd love to eat earthworms and things like that too. And this is a really important wintering feeding ground for them. There were breeding waders. We're hearing more about our breeding waders in Ireland later in the programme. But we're supplemented by others that migrate here for the winter. It's one of the few breeding waders in Ireland that's actually doing relatively well. A lot, as we'll hear later in the programme, a lot of our waders are in trouble in terms of nesting species. But they're joined then by huge influx of other species that come here for the winter months from all over the Northern Hemisphere.
And it's not just here in Dublin Bay, it's indeed all along the Irish Sea, isn't that right?
It is, and even inland in many areas. So we will be hearing later about the IWEBS, the Irish Wetland Bird Survey, which surveys wetlands all across Ireland. It's National Parks and Wildlife Service coordinated by Birdwatch Ireland, and that's why we know where the important wetlands are. And Ireland is home to a huge number of both nationally and internationally important wetlands, including, of course, Bull Island here in Dublin, and this whole area of coast around and the Strand too. Just has this wonderful mixture of habitats, which is what makes it so important.
Niall and Terry, could I cross you there for a second? We're looking at the wonderful pictures, and I want to say thank you very much indeed to our cameraman, Donald Glacken, who's been up since very early this morning. Indeed, for the past few days, he's been out with myself there at the Bull Wall, just checking to see where the birds are taking up position for the feeding as the tide pushes them ever closer to where you guys are standing near the wooden bridge. But at any rate, we're looking at beautiful pictures of oyster catchers, and you can see a small flock of them there. And if you look very closely, you'll notice that some of them, Dr. Richard Collins, are standing on one leg. What's all that about, Richard?
It's about saving heat, Derek. The legs are bare, and of course they lose heat to the environment. So very cleverly, the birds tuck one leg up so that halves the heat loss. They also have a very interesting heat exchange arrangement in which the blood coming down to the foot passes the cold blood coming back up from the foot, and it transfers heat across. It is a very subtle system, but standing on one leg is a necessary evil for these poor birds.
Well, when I was down there the other day with Donald, we noticed that some of the birds, and I'd never seen this before, Richard, Niall and Terry, were actually hopping. And I thought, I've never seen an oyster catcher hop before. And as we looked closely, we realised they're actually hopping on that one leg. And I wondered why they didn't just put the other foot down on the ground and walk.
Indeed, it shows you how critical. Remember, these fellas are very warm. They're at a higher temperature, slightly higher temperature than us. And it's very cold at this time of year. It's very cold where they live. And they're out there 24 hours a day. These are remarkable birds. These oyster catchers are very curious because they are either burglars or safe breakers.
What do you mean, burglars or safe breakers?
Well, yes, an oyster catcher loves to eat cockles. Now, cockles are powerful bivalves. They're very strong muscle holding them together, but they're not tightly closed all the time. They're listening out for a bird coming to eat them, and the oyster catcher is coming to eat them. Now, the oyster catcher creeps up to them as quietly as he can, and he tries to hit them hard on the muscles so that they can't close. If he manages to do that, he will prise open the shells and eat the contents. Now, there's two approaches to this. There's the subtle one, the cat burglar, who creeps in quietly, disables the muscle and eats the contents. And the other one is the crude way. He's got to break open the hard shell of the mussel, and he is the safe breaker approach. The safe breaker approach is much more clumsy, but you get the two types of oyster catcher. Now, some oyster catchers, I'm told, get a blunt bill from years of safe breaking. So my oyster catcher friends tell me the bill gets damaged by it, and they can no longer work the cat burglar strategy. But it seems this is the double strategy they have.
But they really are a beautiful bird, Niall, aren't they?
They're stunning, and as I said, one of the easiest ways is to identify that lovely crisp black and white pattern. There's really no other bird out here like it. Similar to a magpie, I suppose, but you won't see a magpie there wading or out on the mudflats or on the sand. The contrast, though, with that lovely sort of almost carrot orange beak, the reddish pinky legs, the stunning bird. They're also quite feisty in these groups. You'll see a lot of jostling for position, quite literally, because because when they're roosting, especially when it's a blustery, breezy day, they'll want to be in the centre of that flock so that their flock mates on the outside are protecting them, literally shielding them from the wind. And I know as a bird watcher and as a broadcaster, I know what that's like too with the microphones. It's kind of the same sort of process. And it's often people say to me, you know, I find waders hard to identify. Well, start with the oyster catchers. That's really the thing to do. Get to know some of the more common and easy to identify species. Then at least you have a frame of reference so you can compare other birds to it. So certainly the oyster catcher would be the most striking. And it's a good place for them here, Terry, isn't it?
It is indeed. And going back to the beak as well, the beak actually is worn away when they're feeding, because if they didn't feed on this particular food type, their beak would be much, much longer. In fact, I've read somewhere once that the beak grows 3 times as fast as fingernails. So it's a bit like rodents. If you had a pet mouse or a pet guinea pig many, many years ago, you had to throw a block of wood into the cage so that it could gnaw it, so the teeth wouldn't grow through its upper jaw and so on. So it's adapted, it's well adapted, not just the legs, but also the beak.
And those beaks, they're made of exactly the same substance as our fingernails, a protein called keratins, and they do grow constantly through the bird's lives. And the beak of a wader, it's basically Swiss Army knife for the bird, and it's vital to its survival, really important. We would think often of birds' beaks as being quite inert, but most waders have actually a lot of nerve endings right at the tip of their beak. It means they can probe down into the substrate, be it the sand, the mud, the soil, whatever it may be, and they can sense even the most minute vibrations under there of a little passing worm or crustacean or mollusk, and they can grab that there as well. But also, most of these waders, the tips of the beak are actually very flexible, and underneath the mud, they can actually open them, like prising your fingertips apart, or almost like an elephant's trunk. That's what it reminds me of. We rarely see that with our own eyes, because when they're up out of the mud, they don't need to flex their beaks. They just don't bother doing it. But they're amazing all-purpose tools.
Richard wants to come back in there for a second, Terry, if you don't mind.
Yes, yeah. The oyster catcher. There's a story about the oyster catcher that long ago, you see, waders don't swim. They wade. They're reluctant to actually go into the water. Now, apparently long ago, the gull asked the oyster catcher for a loan of its bathing suit. And the oyster catcher was foolish enough to give the gull the bathing suit. But the gull never gave it back. And the oyster catcher could never go swimming after that. And you hear its call, beaglick, 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 which means, look out, look out, don't be fooled like I was.
And I'm looking at some of the birds there as well, Terry, Niall and Richard, and you can see that you're talking about the bill, that long orange bill, very pointed for getting into the sand or taking the meat out of the cockles and the mussels. But at any rate, you can see they're tucking that bill under the wing, Niall.
They are, and that's again all about trying to minimise their profile so that they can be as efficient as possible at retaining that heat. So we can see the cluster of oyster catchers there for those who are watching us on the RT News channel. They're doing that there, and it's a way for them to because it's a breezy morning, it's a way for them to conserve that heat, because that's what they're here for, really. It's about putting on as much energy as possible so they'll be fit for the breeding season in a few months' time. And for those that have migrated, because some of these oyster catchers may have just come from a couple of kilometres away, others may have travelled all the way from Scotland or even Iceland to come to us here, they need to get into the fittest breeding condition they can. So that's why somewhere like Bull Island and these other nature reserves are so important, because disturbance to those birds can cause them a lot of stress, but also cause them to burn up a lot of energy unnecessarily, and that can hinder their breeding chances. So it's great to see them being able to be so undisturbed here and able to just relax. And what they do is, when it's a rising tide at the moment, and that's coming close to the time when these oyster catchers and other waders will be sleeping or roosting, because at this time of year, their sleep cycle is not connected with daylight or with nighttime, it's connected with the tides. When there is exposed mud and sand, when they can feed, even if that's in the middle of the night, they'll be out feeding, getting as much nutrition as they can. And then when the tide comes in and that feeding area is cut off for them, well, then they'll sleep, even if that's right in the middle of the day. So we're starting to see them doing that and still jostling for position as the waves are coming in. Because as Richard said, these birds don't like to swim. They can do it if they have to at a push. I have seen oyster catchers occasionally swimming if they get cut off by the tide. But of course, in those cases, they prefer to fly away from it. But that's why an area this, we have quite a tidal range is so important for these birds.
There's an intriguing cultural mystery here. The name of the oyster catcher in Irish is Gilla Brigia. Gilla Brigia, Bridget's servant. Now, St. Bridget is associated with Kildare. Now, you don't get oyster catchers inland. They are coastal birds. So how on earth did she become associated with the oyster catcher? That's one for the antiquarians to tell us.
We're live on RTE Radio 1 and on the RTE News Channel. Thanks to our colleagues there. And thanks also to our cameraman, Donal Glacken, who's in a hide on a spit down in the North Bull Island. And he's getting fabulous pictures of oyster catchers at the moment. But we'll see more birds as the morning moves on. We'll be looking at these birds, the wetland birds, until 10:30, and then we'll be joining Jim Wilson in Cove in County Cork, and you'll be able to switch over to our website to see fabulous pictures from his garden birds. But I think right now Terry Flanagan is standing by with somebody. Terry.
I'm joined now by Niamh Fitzgerald. Niamh was the National Coordinator of the Irish Wetland Bird Survey for many, many years. Niamh, what exactly is that?
The Irish Wetland Bird Survey is a monitoring scheme funded by the National Parks and Wildlife Service and coordinated by Birdwatch Ireland. It's in its 31st year now, so it's a long-term scheme to monitor the wintering water birds numbers and distribution across Ireland.
Now, you say across Ireland. How many sites are you talking about?
Roughly 300 sites across the whole country, and that encompasses wetlands of all shapes and sizes, from wet grassland to shallow coastline, lakes, rivers, etc. Everything in between.
Well, you're talking about 300 sites. That means you must have at least and probably a lot more than 300 volunteers to do this work. How many do you have?
Yes, on average we have 500 volunteers counting at the moment. Over the lifetime of the survey, there's been over 1,000 people taking part, so it's a huge effort that goes into the scheme.
Now, what species of birds, or how many species of birds are you talking about? Because not all that many species come to the coastline.
It's not all coastline, it's wetlands across the country, so lots of inland sites as well. Birds that are reliant on wetlands, and the species we focus on are common water birds, so that includes your wildfowl, swans, geese and ducks, wading species, gulls, terns at certain times of year. They typically just occur on the coastal sites, the key water bird species who will come here in the winter.
How do you count so many birds? That's a question I've always had in my head, because you come out here to the Bull Island and you look out and maybe a peregrine goes by and you see a flock of something like knot, yeah, and they all take up in the air. And there are hundreds of them. How can you get an accurate number as to how many there would be present here?
Yeah, those flocks in flight are definitely the trickiest ones. But you build up over time a recognition of what groupings of birds look like. So especially when you would learn when they're on the water, on the ground, and start by counting at the edge of a flock in singles. So you might count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, get a sense of what that grouping of five looks like, and then start counting in groups of 5, 10, 15, 20, etc. And for bigger flocks, you would move into bigger groupings, so 20s and hundreds and thousands, maybe, depending on what you're counting. If it's a large flock of knot, as you described, you would maybe be working in hundreds of thousands. And having a clicker is really useful. A tally counter makes that job a lot easier.
How important then is this data, and what do you do with it?
It's incredibly important. A lot of what we know about water birds in Ireland comes specifically from this scheme. And we're, as a state, we are required to report to Europe about the status of water birds and how they're doing. So that information is compiled and sent to Europe every 5 years. And it's also used then for designating sites like special protected areas. In order to take action, we need to know the state of play. So birds are often used as indicator species because they reflect the state of the environment. So that information would be used in that capacity as well.
Well done, Dave. You're doing great work, and long may it continue. So back to you now, Niall.
Thank you very much, Terry. I'm joined by Owen Murphy, who is the project manager of something called the Breeding Wader European Innovation Partnership, or EIP. What's that all about, Owen?
Morning, Niall, and thanks for having me. The Breeding Wader EIP is an ambitious project. It's a five-year project funded by the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine and the National Parks and Wildlife Service. And I suppose our aims are to try and stabilise our breeding wader populations and hopefully turn the corner and maybe start to see some increases in their populations, because the numbers of these birds that are breeding in Ireland have been in dramatic decline for the last 30 to 40 years. And some of them are really, really teetering sort of on the brink of a term called extirpation, which means localized extinction. So some of the birds that are really, really iconic in the Irish landscape, such as curlew, you know, we stand a good chance that they will be gone and no longer part of our breeding birds if we don't do something about it. So it's a €25 million project for the next 5 years. So ambitious in what we want to achieve, but very, very challenging at the same stage.
Absolutely. And the challenges those birds face are many. And I think one of the things that you can sometimes can belie the fact that those birds are in trouble, when you're at somewhere like Bull Island on a day like today, you can see quite a few curlew around. You can see flocks of redshank. You can see snipe if you're lucky flying up. But most of these birds are migrants that are here to spend the winter with us. It's the non-breeding season, of course. In the summer, the core breeding population of those birds, they're in quite a lot of difficulty. What are the main challenges that they're facing?
Yeah, and I think it's one of the things that I encounter quite a bit when I'm talking to people. They say, you know, they nearly think you're making it up. They say, you know, I saw 200 curlew at Bull Island last Saturday or whatever. And as you say, they're migratory. So the birds that remain in Ireland to breed, which are our Irish native breeding stock, they generally move inland or inland, some amount inland to breed. So that can be macker sites, some of our coastal sites, or it can be inland onto to grasslands or bogs. And if we think about how those landscapes have changed over the last 50 years, it's quite dramatic. These birds, they just can't adapt in time. So intensification of agriculture or the changes in timing of what we do agriculturally. We've also afforested a lot of the areas that these birds like to breed in, which would be the sort of marginal land. They're called waders, so they're also always associated with water to some degree. So some of those sort of more, I suppose, areas that are harder to drain, we've put trees into them. And then Ireland has been reliant on commercial peat production for a source of energy since the 1950s, and that has removed a lot of our pristine bogs. So I suppose land use change in all its forms is what really has driven the decline for these birds.
You mentioned afforestation there, and we're often told that obviously planting trees is a good thing, and in many cases it is. We need more trees. But why do they in particular sometimes pose a threat to breeding waders?
Yeah, I mean, these birds, they're all ground nesters. One of the things that, I suppose, unites all waders is that they breed on the ground. And people, I suppose, would say, you know, it's a strange strategy to have taken up. But that's what they do. They utilise wide open spaces. And what they like from their nest is to be able to see a complete 360-degree vista around them. So they're sitting on their nest, they're incubating their eggs or they're with their chicks. They need to see any danger coming. And when I suppose, open landscapes like that become afforested, the landscape closes in and they just won't use it. And a lot of these birds, they disassociate with trees. So even in areas around the country where agriculture has done the opposite of intensification, people have stopped farming certain land. And that, you know, Ireland will always revert back to trees if it's left long enough. So they're reliant on some agricultural activity. Mm-hmm. They're reliant on a certain management of land to ensure that scrub and trees don't encroach on their breeding areas. What they're looking for is a fine balance, really. They need that wide open space. And if they see a predator coming, then they'll take two choices. They'll either hunker down and hide. They're very, very well camouflaged. A lot of these are really cryptic species, so they're not easy to see, or else they will evade, they will fly off. So they will take that decision. But once they can't see around them, they start to feel a little bit uneasy.
Absolutely. And we can see here, even in the wintering grounds here at Bull Island, one of the reasons why it's so popular with waders is because you have this 360-degree view. They can see all around them. They know they're protected by water on some sides. So things like dogs and foxes, it's going to be very hard to find them. But also there's safety in numbers, because I often see things like peregrine falcons and merlins here, birds of prey that would hunt these wading birds. If you're in a group, there's more pairs of eyes looking out for danger. It's also, I suppose, more likely when that danger comes that it'll be your neighbour who gets grabbed rather than you. But some of our breeding waders as well in the summer, there's that colonial aspect to them. And I know that as those populations, birds like lapwing, for example, one of my favourites, as they get more fragmented, it's harder for them to watch out and defend themselves against predators.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you fall below a certain population threshold and it becomes harder for these birds to survive. And I mean, we have a couple of great examples. Birdwatch yourselves have done great work down in Anna Marsh. They have a predator-proof fence down there. And NPWS have done lovely work down in Kilcool. Similarly, starting with very small breeding bird populations and really, really rapidly increasing those populations. And then you see a more natural system. You will see lapwing in good numbers. They're very, very feisty birds. They're wonderful birds to look at on breeding grounds. And if they see a grey crow or they see a peregrine or something, they will go up and they will mob it and they will drive it away. And subsequently, other birds come in behind them. So often where you have a strong breeding lapwing colony, you will see redshank and other breed, you know, snipe and other turning up in with them, because they also benefit from that defensive mechanism that the lapwing produce. So, yeah, no, it's very much so. When birds become isolated and sporadic, and this is the problem we're having with curlew at the minute. We have areas that have one and two pairs of breeding curlew in a landscape that's really, really degraded for them, and it's very, very challenging to do anything with those birds. You know, they're really, really struggling.
Now, one of the species we've been seeing a lot on screen on the RTÉ News channel, Owen, it's the oyster catcher, a bird which is a breeding wader within Ireland. Is that part of your EIP work?
It is, yeah. We I suppose, have a duty of care to 10 different species and another couple that may turn up. The only breeding wader in Ireland that we don't feature is woodcock, but purely because their breeding strategies are so different and they use woodland. But yeah, oyster catcher breed along our coasts, but they're also turning up, and we have strong breeding oyster catcher populations on the Lake of Loch Ree, which is quite unusual. You know, they're away from the coast. They're using a freshwater lake, but they're doing quite well there. Obviously, lots and lots of invertebrates on some of the islands for them to feed on. But a wonderful bird. One of the few waders, actually, that feed their chicks. They actively feed chicks. So they do turn up, I think, in certain areas, feeding on rooftops and stuff where, you know, most of the wader chicks are nidificous, so they leave the nest like, you know, farmyard hens or that. So the chicks go about and feed themselves, whereas with oyster catchers, yeah, they're fed by the adults, so you can often see them when you watch them collecting food and bringing it over. So unusual for waders in that regard.
And one of the birds we're seeing there on the screen on the RTÉ News channel, it's a bird called a grey plover. To any listeners in North America, the black-bellied plover, the same species. Now, that's not a breeding wader here in Ireland. That migrates down to us from the Arctic. But we do have a closely related and very similar-looking species here called the golden plover, which you can also find here often in big flocks at Bull Island. The grey plovers tend to be by themselves or in pairs, where the golden plovers are often in flocks of thousands. As a breeding species, though, that's another one that's in difficulty.
It is, yeah. Golden plover are doing poorly as well. Like that's what you said. I mean, I was on the Shannon Callows doing some bird watching yesterday, and big, big flocks of golden plover, but all coming down from Iceland and from far northern reaches. Our Irish golden plover are in difficulty. They're confined to, you know, a few areas. They're upland breeders, sort of upland bogs and those sort of areas. Again, not doing well. Predation been a big issue, you would imagine. So ground nesting birds. UCD actually published a paper very recently that shows that birds that use ground nesting as a breeding strategy as opposed to other strategies such as nesting in trees or cliffs are, you know, 85 or 86% more likely to be in decline in Europe than the others. So, I mean, particularly vulnerable, yes, and golden plover not doing well at all, I'm afraid, and a beautiful, beautiful bird. Their breeding plumage is absolutely remarkable.
One of the things that that I must admit irks me when I'm at a place like this, or all around Ireland, you see it often on beaches, these flocks of birds like golden plover gather together, and then someone just absentmindedly lets their dog run through the middle of them, scares them all up. That actually can be quite devastating for the breeding success, even for some birds down the line months later.
Oh, it is, of course, yeah. I mean, when birds return to a breeding ground, they must be in good condition. It takes a lot of energy for a female to produce eggs. When you see the like of curlew, they're big, big eggs, and the eggs are the size of large hen eggs that you buy in your shop. So it takes a lot of input and a lot of energy to produce them. It also takes a lot of energy to defend your nest. I mean, you see these birds on breeding grounds, they're constantly active, they're constantly alert, and if they come back to breeding grounds in poor condition, it stands to reason that their chances of being successful are greatly reduced. So it's really, really important. And I think there's a big onus on us to push it nationally that, you know, things as simple as letting dogs off a lead in their own place, whether that's in breeding time or whether it's in wintering time, it can have effects. We think we're the only one doing it, but somebody comes in afterwards and does the same thing, and it's continuous disturbance. And it either stops birds breeding in areas, or it means that they're unsuccessful. And again, during the winter time, they don't go back into their, either leave on migration in good enough condition or fly inland to breeding grounds in good enough condition.
We're seeing some birds on the screen there, another type of wader called a turnstone, which again is not an Irish breeding species, although it is one you can find here during the summer months, because we get some first year birds that aren't fully adult that do stay here with us. Most of our turnstones, it seems, come to us from Atlantic Canada and parts of Greenland, and they come here. That really shows, like, it's a real melting pot, Ireland, isn't it? It's very important. It's at the very edge of the range of many of these species. But that also means that some of these species that breed here, they're more prone to disappear. Very often species at the edge of their range, they have a hard time.
Yeah, they certainly do, and Turnstone are one of those ones. I mean, they're circumpolar. They breed in most areas of tundra all around the Northern Hemisphere. I think there's a black Turnstone on the Pacific coast of America that's closely related, but beautiful birds. It's just amazing. It always amazes me how birds that are so small can undertake such migrations successfully. And I mean, I suppose waders, one of the reasons why waders, I think, that you know, they need special attention is that they're around for a long, long time. Fossil mm-hmm. records show waders back 70 or 80 million years ago, which is way, way longer than passerines or perching birds or songbirds. They're around. I mean, there's Tringa-type species like redshank in fossilized records, and you would think it was a redshank or a yellow leg. So they're around a long, long time. They're very, very ancient species. And I suppose 100 years of human activity could wipe them out in the Lake of Ireland. So, I mean, it really is important that we do something about it.
And I'm just watching them there. And the reason they're called the Turnstone Rich is because I think they turn the stones over and they look for the little insects that they're going to feed on.
Yes, they do. They are very interesting birds. They leave no stone unturned. And that's true of all waders. These are very adventurous creatures. They're not stuck in mud in the estuaries all the time.
As I mentioned, this morning's broadcast was not just about waders in our wetlands. Our own backyards, gardens and feeders are important sustenance to a whole range of species, from robins and tits to starlings. It's incredible to think that in the midst of winter's chill, these little sanctuaries in our gardens can make all the difference. Jim Wilson was our man in Cove, and he had a camera trained on the hanging feeders in his back garden.
Good morning, Derek. How are we doing?
Very good. Tell us what's going on there.
There was a group of sparrows and they just left. They must have heard you saying about not working with animals and children and took offence and disappeared. So at the moment, it's empty on the feeders out there. I've got the peanut feeder, but I also put up the seed cake feeder just for variety. And I'm able to move the camera, and not very well because I'm at a stretch to the microphone. But if anything turns up, I'll move around on it. But great view. My office, which is in the garage, looks out onto the garden, and it's been fantastic activity here again while keeping an eye on all things Bull Island this morning
as well. You're a busy man. You've got to have more than two eyes. Now, Jim, we're looking at the hanging feeder. Just tell me exactly what's in that. Now, this would be a common thing most people would have in their gardens or in their backyards or maybe even on their windowsill, but just talk us through it. What nuts have you got in there, please?
I've just got ordinary peanuts in this one, whole peanuts. Make sure when you're buying them that they look like peanuts you would eat, but don't eat them because they're a different grade. But visually, they should look the very same as ones you would buy to eat, unsalted ones. And I've put them in the mesh feeder. And what I've done, and I've always done, is if you get a mesh feeder, take the bottom off it, because no matter how well drained looking it is, mm-hmm. it will hold water and it'll start to rot the peanuts.
Lovely.
So what I do is I remove the bottom. The wire mesh is very flexible. And I, as you can see, I've folded it over. So it's just peanuts and wire mesh and all the water can drain away. And what happens with the peanuts is if they get wet, they can go moldy. They can come with a bit of mold that can grow then. And it's an aflatoxin, which is actually poisonous to the birds. So you don't want to be killing them with your kindness, basically. So That's the basic setup that anyone can put up. And you would be amazed just how quickly birds in your neighbourhood or in the countryside will actually find it. Because these birds are always on the lookout for a food opportunity. Unlike the wetland birds we've been looking at, which, you know, they go to the dinner table, which is the mud flat, and the food is in there somewhere. Whereas with the garden birds and their cousins out on the wider countryside, they'll go to favourite spots, but if there's nothing there for some reason, they've got to go find another one. And I've seen them when I've watched from upstairs in the house. I've a view out over the suburban landscape I have here, and I can see them beelining from one garden to one that's quite far away. And so they hop around. We've got a group of long-tailed tits coming at the moment. We had 19 on the feeder yesterday evening. Incredible sight. But you could nearly set your watch with those. They come in not long after dawn, 8:30, 9:00. They stay about 5 or 10 minutes and then they disappear and we don't see them till the evening. So if there's no activity, don't panic. It means the birds are moving around. In fact, I would be worried if you had birds on your feeders 24/7. It would suggest they've become sort of habituated to it, or there's no other food anywhere in sight. And the best thing to do is to see as they come and go. There's always a change, which is fantastic. And you never know what's going to turn up. And of course, we do the Winter Garden Bird Feeding Survey, which we do every year. The Garden Bird Survey is incredible. I think it's now the longest running citizen science project, probably anyway, in Ireland. And basically, we're watching to see how many birds are using our garden and what types of species. And you would be amazed in a week. Even where we are here now, we can rack up over 20 species in a week easily. And this morning, just looking out the window, I've at least 10, maybe 12 species. That's not uncommon. And wherever you are, you'll have a different set of species too, depending what the landscape is around your house. I mean, these birds at the moment are getting sparrows. I don't know why. Some people say, all I'm getting is bloody sparrows. They're scaring everything else off. Listen, just step back and go with the flow. These birds, believe it or not, have declined in huge numbers across Europe, including Britain and Ireland.
I remember back in the day, Jim, I think it was the London Independent offered £10,000 for anybody who could give a reasonable explanation as to why the sparrows had declined. And some were saying it was due to the fact there was no longer horses on the roads and the oats that would spill out and all that kind of stuff. And the sparrows thrived then. But you take, but they were gone for, God, when was the last time a horse was on the road?
Definitely some changes will not be immediate. And I think it's a combination of lots of things. Our farming practices, because The sparrow got its name because it used nest, especially under thatch, in farmhouses and outbuildings. That's where it gets the name house sparrow. And as a result, they were very common around farms because a lot of the farming was subsistence. It wasn't intensive. So you had a lovely mix of arable crops, root crops, all sorts of things, which provided them with lots of food to raise lots of families. And so lots of sparrows around. And yes, for sure, in the towns and cities, horses, you know, would have been used as well. And you'd get some of them there. And they're generalists, sparrows are. They're very inquisitive when it comes to food. They're not locked into one particular type of food. And that makes their decline even more dramatic. So really, the bottom line is we don't know for sure, but we do know quite a number of factors that have definitely contributed to their decline, both natural and human made.
It's a surprise that the sparrow should decline. This is one of the world's most successful birds. There was a fellow who thought he would introduce to the United States every bird species mentioned in Shakespeare's works. And almost all of them failed completely. But two have done spectacularly well. One is the starling, and the other is the house sparrow. Things like goldfinches, a few survive apparently still in America, but it shows you just how adaptable this little beastie is. He is well able to make a go of it. So the fact that he should be declining in Irish cities and towns, that is most unexpected, most extraordinary.
Eugene Scheifen, his name was, Richard. He was the guy who introduced all the birds.
Yes, you're a good man yourself. I couldn't remember his name.
That's all right.
It came to me. I noticed, funny thing, in Dublin, they seemed to survive where people resided. I remember going to the Liberties and finding there were sparrows, well, not galore, but plenty of them. Whereas you went to Stephen's Green, a kilometre away, there were none there at all. Now, that's very strange. For instance, O'Connell Street, when it was occupied, when people lived there, that is, full time, there were sparrows. But then when it became purely a commercial and administrative street, they disappeared. There are mysteries here, very interesting mysteries, but I have no solution to them.
Yeah, just now on the feeder, we got a greenfinch.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a species that I'm afraid declined quite dramatically in gardens, both in Ireland and abroad, over the last couple of decades. And they're pretty sure a lot of it was down to bad hygiene around your feeding areas, because you are creating an artificial situation where a lot of birds of different species are coming into the one place and then they go off and spread out and they come back again. So if one of them has a disease of some description, there's a higher chance that they will be passed on. And for most of the birds, they're very robust, but there was trichomonosis, I think, is one of the names for it. It's an infection that basically affects the respiratory system and that. And it appears that greenfinches were particularly susceptible to it. And they do think that the greenfinch numbers decline, especially in suburban and garden areas, because it spread through their coming to feeders. And really, there's a way of avoiding that, and that is treat your feeding area like you would your food for the table. You don't leave the place get messy all the time. And of course, they're pooping all over the place and they're on the feeder. So what you really need to do is on a regular basis, I usually do it about once a week or once a fortnight at the outside, is I take down the feeders, I give them a dip in 10 to 15% bleach or something like that, give them a rinse, put them back up, maybe even change the nuts. Because what happens is if you put the nuts into the feeder and you top it up, the ones that are at the bottom will stay there and may be there for a couple of weeks. Whereas at least if I put new ones in, I put a few in, I shake it up, put in more in, shake it up so that they're mixed in, so that you're not getting this stagnation of peanuts at the bottom. And really what you do then is just clean everything like that. Clean your bird table. I hose down under the where I have the feeders. I always give it a hose down every couple of days, partly because they poop all over the tables and the chairs that are out or whatever else is there. So it's just good hygiene habit. And if we all did that, we would be providing a much safer, more secure food source for these birds. Because I do know a lot of people say, you know, are you not just sort of doing it for your own fun and your, you know, that's all it is. It's just to gratify your own emotions and nothing else. Well, you must remember, we have taken away huge swathes of habitat as we've developed as a species. And I think we're kind of just giving a little bit back here to help some species get through the harder times. And believe you me, before I forget, Derek, I was looking at the forecast. I don't know what it's going to be like up the country, but by Friday, we're going to be down in the minus ones, minus twos, feeling like minus six or eight, according to the Met AirNap. And that's when the birds really will find it hard, because as Richard rightly mentioned, and as you were discussing with the wetland birds, garden birds are no different. Their energy, their warmth is from what they eat. And if they can't eat or can't get enough to feed, then they lose energy. They then die eventually because they can't get enough. And so when it's very cold, that's very, very important time to do it. And some people ask me is, what'll happen if I stop feeding them? Because that's what you've got to do if you do find a sick bird in your garden. You clean everything down, but you don't put up food for about 2 or 3 weeks and then start again. I guarantee you, they are not just your garden birds. No. And this has been shown.
They're nobody's birds.
No, they're nobody's birds, exactly. But you know what I mean? I always put parentheses when I say that our birds are your bird, which is fair enough, but they're not. If you tag the garden birds in your garden for a whole winter, you will discover you've got a hell of a lot more blue tits and sparrows and whatever coming to your garden than you always thought there was just one or two. Because when we do the garden bird survey, we have to record the most of each species we can see at any one time. Not if I see one on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, that I have seven blue tits, that could be just the one. But they all look the same. And so we think we might have one or two, and maybe you do, but there have definitely been many, many ringing studies, tagging studies done to prove that you may have upwards of tens of blue tits over the winter period. Yeah. So you're not just keeping your blue tit or your robin or whatever. Well, robins are a bit more territorial. You're actually helping a larger number of birds within that habitat and within the environs of where you're living.
Okay, now, Jim, we have tons of emails coming in and text messages, needless to say, so we're going to try and get through a lot of them. This question is going to relate to you, Niall. You can tell us a little bit about it, and then we'll crack on with all the questions. Are you there again, Niall, from the North Pole Wall? And can I just say thank you to Niall, and thank you to Terry Flanagan, and to Niamh Dunn, our researcher, and to Donal, our cameraman, and everybody else who helped us with that broadcast this morning on the RTE News Channel and on RTE Radio 1. Fantastic job, and it was great to see those live pictures, so thank you for that. Now, hi Derek, really enjoying the wonderful programme on RTE News Channel today. Well done to all involved. We will be doing our return for the Garden Bird Survey later, says Michael in Terenure. Niall.
I'm delighted to hear that. Thank you very much. Yes, the Irish Garden Bird Survey, I know that it's something that we've been doing for many years. Jim was actually the person who originated it. It's been going strong for nearly 40 years now. And the fact is that the people who contribute the data to that survey and send it to us in Birdwatch Ireland, it makes an enormous difference. That's how we know how our garden birds are faring. And when you have almost four decades worth of data and records there, you really see shifting things happening. So the data, even the birds that may be common one day, like the sparrows used to be, like the greenfinches used to be, we see changes in their populations, declines of the sparrows, as you were discussing, declines in the greenfinches because of that disease. So it tells us a lot about that. So thank you to everyone who's taking part. And we know that many Mooney Goes Wild listeners, literally thousands of them across Ireland, take part in the Irish Garden Bird Survey each winter. It's not too late to start because it runs right through to the end of February. So you've still got several weeks, 2 months essentially, to continue to take part. We ask people to keep track of the different birds they see in their garden, the highest number they see at any one time on any weekly basis. It's lots of fun.
Jim, this one for you. Derek, really enjoying the wonderful programme on RTE News Channel as well. And it says, the robin, it's about the robin. As a ground feeder, it can't stroke, doesn't cling to the bird feeder. And the crows and starlings immediately clear the bird table. What to do? Asks Marion.
Well, we've got robins that are very capable, and they cling to the feeders all the time, actually, when they get a chance. Again, you're back to maybe taking sides as to what birds you want and don't want in some respects. But I know one way that it works for me is I have over years come to a design of bird table. But the roof is very, very low. Most of the bird tables you'll see in garden centres are more for aesthetic ornament appearance rather than actual functionally good bird feeding tables. But if you've got a table with a very low roof on it, I mean, the gap between the roof and the table is no more than if you hold your hand vertically, the four fingers, and I guarantee you the robin will find its way in, the other birds find their way in, but the bigger birds can't. They're just too big. You can also get, it looks like, I think sometimes they get them as squirrel excluding ones. You can get ones that are in it within a mesh ball, for example. So the feeder's in the middle. And if you could imagine then a ball of mesh around it. And the holes are plenty big enough for your smaller birds to get in, but not so much for the bigger ones. But the robin, in fairness, most of the time the robin feeds on the ground or in trees. It's not a regular peanut feeder attendee, so to speak. But that is one way of trying it. And other ways they use them, I've seen people use on, if you want to feed them on the ground, get something like an old shopping basket. You know, the hand, the little small one.
Yeah.
I've seen people use one of those. Now, don't go down to your Nordic store and steal one. But if you can get something like that, again, they can get through the holes and a robin would get through those and feed and come back out, whereas the bigger birds can't.
Just looking at the live feed from your garden again, Jim, and the hanging feeder has a sparrow on it. It had a blue tit too, and a greenfinch came in just now and the sparrow has pushed it off. It's quite aggressive, that little sparrow. Is it male or female?
I think we've got a female house sparrow. And
yes,
you can tell her by her, she's very, very plain all the way down the front. She doesn't have any dark chestnut on the head either. Whereas when the males come in, you'll see a black bib of varying size. It gets bigger as the breeding season comes in, as the feathers wear. And they are very competitive about what they want to eat. And the greenfinch and the house sparrow, there was a greenfinch just in again
there. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. They spend more time actually chasing each other off sometimes than actually feeding. Another female after dislodging one. We know we have about 14 house sparrows a maximum per week. But sometimes on the feeder, there's only one or two. They get very... And what's very interesting, I'm just going to move the camera and you'll see that, oh, now you've got the green finch on one side. Look, oh, and you can see the yellow on the green finch.
Wow, that's amazing, yeah.
Look at that. Now, there's the yellow, and there's a female house sparrow on the left. But very similar build. Greenfinch has a heavier beak, but you can see the green on it. That's where it gets its name. But they've got these flashes of yellow on the wings and the tail as well, which sets them apart from the other ones. The greenfinch has moved off.
Another question here for you, Niall Hatch. My goldfinches have all disappeared. I had them for around 4 weeks, feeding them Niger seeds. Now no sign of them, says Evelyn in Louth. Cadhain an scéal.
Well, Niger seed, certainly you're feeding them the right thing. They absolutely love it. It's this thin black seed that mimics a thistle seed, and it's exactly right up the street for what a goldfinch would want. Now, goldfinch flocks do rove around during the course of the winter, and the last couple of weeks have been relatively mild, so they will have been able to find quite a bit of natural food. I even saw a butterfly the other day out and about, a small tortoiseshell butterfly, just how mild it had been. But as Jim was saying, that weather is going to turn in the next few days. It's going to get a lot colder, and I wouldn't be surprised if all of a sudden your goldfinches come crawling back into the garden in search of those Niger seeds. So do keep putting them out there, and do be prepared over the next few weeks to help the birds, and especially as well as to add, put out water for the birds as well, because when the ponds and the pools freeze over, it's very hard for them to find enough water to drink and to bathe. So make sure they're well looked after and they'll keep coming back for more.
Back to you now, Jim, and I can see on the monitor there's a starling on the hanging feeder. A beautiful bird, very large in comparison to the sparrows and the finches and the blue tits. And of course, this is the time of year when you can observe the starling murmurations overhead.
Absolutely. I mean, they are for me one of the most beautiful birds in Ireland, to be frankly honest. And especially when you look at them closely, that iridescent plumage. Look at the back. There's greens and there's blacks and there's blues. It's the light hitting the feathers that's causing that colour. It's not a pigment as such. Magpies have it as well. But the murmurations, some of these murmurations, as we've known from the programme in the past, can reach tens, if not hundreds of thousands of birds. Loch Ennell is a very famous place for them. We went to Knobber near Dublin and we had, it must have been 200,000 birds a few years back. But they don't always go to the same place every year, although they will do it for quite a number of years.
Yeah.
And they will just come in and they act like an organism. One thinks that it's coordinated. In the past, people used to say, oh, there's a leader. There's a leader of that group, you know, and they're all following the leader. But in fact, they're not really doing that. They're kind of avoiding each other, really. Like,
well, they never seem to crash. We've witnessed like many as a murmuration, myself and Richard.
Yeah.
Richard. Belfast under the Albert Bridge.
Oh, yes, that was a wonderful thing. And one of the interesting...
I should say over the Albert Bridge. They roost under the Albert Bridge.
We were under it on a boat.
We were looking up at
it. It was a wonderful experience, something you never forget. These murmurations benefit the birds of prey. That's an interesting thing. You will invariably see peregrines around, sparrowhawks, and they cash in on this. It's a great source of sustenance for these top of the food chain birds in winter, and that is a benefit. We probably think, oh, isn't it awful, the peregrine killing the starling? We only kill the odd one, but he needs it more than they do in a sense at that hard time of year. They are marvellous creatures, the starlings, and you mentioned the lack of a pigment. What they've done there is they've built the crystalline structure of the feather enables the colour of the bird to change as it turns. It's not like a pigment. So sometimes it looks reddish, sometimes it looks green and purplish and everything else. So it's a very exalted form of camouflage that you're able to vary it by simply moving slightly. They are wonderful birds from that point of view. They're very gregarious, of course. Mm-hmm. They were once rather rare in Ireland at the beginning of the 19th century. Now we have huge numbers, but they fluctuate enormously. They've gone down a lot in the last few years, but they'll come back again.
Niall, another one for you from Jerry, who says, I think that there is an overuse of bird feeding, and it is disrupting the balance of birds as the stronger birds are outnumbering the smaller birds. Birds should be allowed to forage naturally, and this also keeps pests under control. I don't use feeders in my garden and have lots of birds foraging as I have the habitat grown. What do you say to that?
Well, certainly having good habitat, that's a very good thing to do for wildlife, because it's only a certain suite of species that will actually come to your garden feeders, and the vast majority of Irish bird species won't go next to nigh or near a garden feeder. So doing things that support the insects, the native plants and plant communities, that's very important. Now, there's many schools of thought when it comes to feeding birds, but one of the things is we don't really live in a very natural environment at all anymore. We've really hit the populations of those birds very badly. So actually redressing the balance by helping to feed some of those species in gardens, it can do a lot to help boost their numbers. It is really important to make sure the feeders are kept clean, that the right type of food is used. But on balance, I think that it certainly does more good than harm. But just bearing in mind, of course, that it's only a very select suite of species that benefit from it. Most birds don't go to gardens. Even then, we've seen, even from studies over many years, not just in Ireland, but in many countries, that the birds really only use the garden feeders just to supplement their diets. I know they're on Jim's camera feed. It looks like they're just gorging themselves. But the fact is, they'll go off and they'll feed on other food throughout the day. And they just use that garden food just to supplement the diet until the weather gets really tough. And then they can be a lifeline for them. One of the beauties of bird feeders, it's a great way to get to know the birds. It gets children particularly really enthusiastic about them. And then you have converts to the world of birds and the joy of nature for life, which I think is another very strong benefit to them and a good argument for them.
So, whether it's the wild open spaces of our wetlands or the humble bird feeders in our backyards, we can all do our bit to support these winter visitors. Until next time, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye!
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.